Good morning, Arizona. I just want to remind everybody that starting next week and moving forward, the show will be on at 8 a.m. And our guest today is Pima County Sheriff Mark Napier. Thank
you. Good morning. How are you?
Doing great. And I appreciate you getting up early. This is our last early show.
Yeah, sheriffs have no days off. So that works out just fine.
Okay, good. When I told everybody that you were going to be on the show, I got a slew of emails and questions from people. And I want to start with that grant.
The Stone Garden grant, yeah.
Yeah, that people have been talking about. What happened with that?
Well, it still has yet to happen.
Okay.
The Board of Supervisors will vote on that on May 7th at the regular board meeting. I feel encouraged that we'll get a positive vote this time. There really are no good reasons, no thoughtful reasons to vote the grant down. There just aren't. There are a lot of emotional reasons and contrived reasons, but the grant is solid. This county accepted that grant for 12 years with no problem. We're the only county that I'm aware of in the whole United States that was awarded a grant and then rejected it. So that puts us out on an island to ourselves that we ought to be paying attention to. The Cochise County Board of Supervisors approved their Stone Garden grant 5-0. It was unanimous. Marana's approved the grant. Tucson Police Department has approved the grant. And here we are debating whether we should, as the largest border county in the United States. That just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. And it's our money, our taxpayer money being given back to us to help secure the area and make sure that we can pay our officers.
Well, it provides me a lot of money for overtime.
Right.
It provides money for equipment. But the new extension of that grant, which is important that people understand this. Now, we're having the influx of asylum seekers here in the Pima County area because Border Patrol, once they're granted an asylum hearing, Border Patrol no longer has any reason to hold them. So they're releasing them into the community, which is really stressing our nonprofits that are trying to help these people because you can't just let them wander the streets.
Right.
And one of the things that Stone Garden will allow moving forward is reimbursement for indirect humanitarian cost, which you would think the more liberal members of the Board of Supervisors would embrace as money coming back to Tucson
right.
to help a cause they allegedly care about. So I'm very hopeful. We've made great strides in Washington, D.C. I have great partners there in D.C. that have listened to sheriffs, especially Sheriff Daniels, who I know you're very close with, Sheriff Wilmot over in Yuma County. And I have really made inroads in Washington, D.C. And I think that a lot of the reason that we're seeing an extension of Stone Garden funding into more community-based areas is because we've been pushing for that.
Right.
And I think Washington, D.C. is listening.
Okay. Is this group who's protesting it and trying to stonewall it, no pun intended, are they going to be at that meeting where they do the vote on the 7th?
Well, I'm certain that that will be a very active meeting. I'm sure there will be people there that will be very animated, very emotional. But all of that aside, there isn't any reason to do so. This is a very, very simple grant. It allows me to deploy our deputies,
right.
our deputies, these are our people, out into
our security, our safety.
Well, they're our neighbors. I mean, these deputies don't come in from Mars. I love these people. I have the greatest respect for our deputies, and I don't think there's any reason that any member of the public should feel uncertain or uneasy about our deputies being deployed in our county. And that's what this grant allows me to do, and it allows me to buy equipment that we use for the benefit of Pima County. And then we're going to pursue some humanitarian aid to help the nonprofits take care of these people that we have to take care of them once they're released in the community.
So the people who want this grant to be voted on in a positive way should also show up at this meeting and give reasons why we should be voting in a positive way for this grant to help our community.
I certainly encourage them to. I mean, the loudest noise in the room seems to be the only noise.
Yes.
And too often we don't allow our voice to be heard. And then I think it's important that we, especially Republicans, I think, need to speak calmly and about the facts and non-emotionally.
Keep your head on your shoulders.
Right. People criticize me sometimes because I'm very measured. I don't get very excited about things. I just don't see any reason. I don't call people names, any of that ridiculous stuff, because I think it's beneath the dignity of the office. So I try to purport myself as a professional, and I know it sounds corny, but I'm an Iowa farm boy at heart, and I try to be the kind of man my mother would want me to be, and that means a lot to me.
Exactly. If you can't do it in front of grandma, don't do it at all.
Yeah, there's a saying when I was a young cop that if you're talking to somebody and you wouldn't say it if your mother was standing behind you, you shouldn't say it.
Exactly. Okay, there was, this was brought to my attention, there was an article in the news about vigilantes and this national militia guarding the border. You know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is that affecting Cochise County and Pima County, and what's going on down there?
Well, we have some groups around the Arivaca area, but not to the extent that we read about in the article. I don't embrace the militia movement. I think it's a dangerous element because you have interjected now more armed people into this environment, many of which, despite what they say, a lot of them purport to have military training. But I confronted one of these persons one day, and I said, well, what branch of service were you in? He said, well, I was in the Army. And I said, oh, really? Where'd you do your basic training? And he said, Virginia. I said, Virginia, there is no basic training depot for the United States Army in Virginia. And then the person says, well, I don't remember where I did my basic training. And I said, why don't you take the soldier hat off and get the hell out of here, because you're fake. Everybody who's been in the military knows where they did their basic training. I did mine at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. You don't forget that.
No.
So a lot of these people want to play a soldier, but they're armed people that my people don't know good people from bad people. And
exactly.
And they're not trained. We really don't need the help. Not that kind of help. We don't need that kind of help. There are 4,000 Border Patrol agents in this county. I want to deploy my deputies out there under Stone Garden funding. I'm not interested in the help from militias at all.
Yeah, the photograph they had in the on the internet was a man wearing a camouflage jacket, and it had a badge on it. And I was trying to zoom in on the badge, and it said, you know, something about a fugitive recovery agent. I was like, what the heck is that?
Well, a lot of these people claim right-wing ideology, and under that dogma, they only recognize a single constitutional authority. And under their belief system, that only legitimate authority in a county is the sheriff. That's the only authority they recognize. And I am the sheriff, and I'm not asking for their help, and they should respect that. If you're going to play the role, you got to play it all the way. You got to play by your own rules. And what I'm saying as a sheriff of this county is, I'm not interested in your help right now. This is not helping us. It's not helping the cause.
No, it's hindering.
It's hindering, and it's a dangerous interjection of another element into this environment we don't need.
I remember years ago, they had a vigilante group on the border, and I used to be a Tombstone vigilante, the reenactment group. So when you tell people you're a vigilante, they like, oh, and then no, not that one. you know, but that was a big thing going on down there. Okay, I know you just got back from D.C., and you're actually going back to D.C. Tell us what's going on with Washington.
Well, I have, I've been traveling a little bit. There's a lot of stuff going on with the border, and the one thing that I know, Sheriff Daniels and Sheriff Wilmot and I believe, as three of the of larger border sheriffs, is you've got to have your voice being heard. If you're not there, somebody else is speaking purportedly for you. And some of those voices we're not comfortable with. So I was in Del Rio, Texas last week at the Border Sheriff's Conference over there. Talked to a lot of federal authorities, a lot of border sheriffs, had good discussions with COPS Office, FEMA, Department of Homeland Security. We had a conference call with the new acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Kevin McAleenan, who I like a great deal. But the way we are getting these things changed is by having our voice directly heard. And you got to do that by talking to people one-on-one. And so I was in Texas, and I was over in California. President invited me to go over to California to an event in Calexico, and then invited me to speak at that event, which I was grateful for. I know the sheriffs really want to get more time with the president. I think that he needs to hear from us, not through three or four intermediaries, but sit down with border sheriffs, not just any sheriff, but a border sheriff. And we need to have a very private discussion with the president about what is really going on the border. Because I don't know that he hears everything he needs to hear all the time. I'll be in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. I've been invited to testify before Congress on the Border Security Facilitation and Operations Subcommittee of the Department of Homeland Security Committee of Congress.
Aren't you on that committee?
No, Sheriff Daniels is.
You were appointed to a committee, though.
Well, I'm the chair of the Border Security Committee for Major County Sheriffs of America.
Okay.
I also sit as a member of Southwest Border Sheriffs Coalition, vice president of the Arizona Sheriffs Association. So I keep my, I'm on the executive committee of Major County Sheriffs. I tend to be pretty
busy.
Involved. I keep myself very busy, but I think it's important that we don't allow Pima County to be an island. You know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. I don't want our county to be on the menu. I want us to be heard from. I think we have a unique perspective on border issues here in Pima County that needs to be heard. And sometimes people agree with that, and sometimes they don't. But despite all the rhetoric, there are some very core issues that I think everybody agrees about. Our border's not secure. It's a public safety concern. It's a national security concern. And it's a human rights issue. And we need to have our voice heard in Washington, D.C., and then throughout the border sheriffs region, because there are only 31 of us border sheriffs, and Pima County is the largest.
And when you say 31, you're talking northern and southern border.
No, that's just
the southern border.
Yeah, between California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas.
Okay.
There are 31 border sheriffs. The thing that's important to me is there are only three of those 31 that qualify to be major county sheriffs, and that's San Diego, El Paso, and Pima County. El Paso's not been involved at all, which is disappointing. San Diego is in California. It's got its own issues. So if we're going to be heard at the major county sheriff's level, it has to come from Pima County. And otherwise, what major county sheriffs do is they appoint a sheriff from Indiana to go to Washington, D.C. to talk about border issues.
That makes no sense.
That makes no sense at all. And despite the fact the sheriff may be very intelligent, very capable.
He's not experienced anything.
They've never been to the border. Or if they have, they've been to a port of entry where they got their picture taken for 20 minutes and they went home. Well, that's not the border.
Yeah.
I've been in this valley for 32 years. Been to the border multiple times. I mean the real border. I think we have a good perspective on what is really going on down here.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Pima County Sheriff Mark Napier. I just noticed you had it on your shirt.
Yeah, nice, that's, I'm not exactly undercover. Yeah.
Okay, we've been talking about border issues and being represented in Washington, not through a third party, but actually boots on the ground in Washington, so to speak. Let's talk about the difference between the northern border and the southern border.
Well, the one thing, let me go back to your first comment that I think is really important. Secretary Nielsen, before she was dismissed, had a process that I thought was really great. There were about eight sheriffs that she would get on a conference call with about once every 2 to 3 weeks. And she was excellent about, she would give us a briefing that was confidential briefing, one-on-one from her to us. And she would say, here's what's going on in Washington, D.C. Here's some things that we're doing. And then she would call on each sheriff on the call and say, Sheriff, tell me what's going on in your county. Tell me what I need to know. And I was one of those. Leon Wilmot was the other one. Sheriff Daniels was another one. And there were some sheriffs over in Texas that were also on the call. That was great. And we really had an excellent relationship with Secretary Nielsen. I'm happy to say that we had a conference call with Secretary, Acting Secretary McClellan, and he is going to continue that process of us on conference calls. So our voice will be directly heard at the highest levels of government, and that's because we've taken the time to develop those relationships. There are fundamental differences between the southern border and the northern border. The northern border is more remote. We're not seeing the drug trafficking through there. Certainly we don't see the human trafficking from Central America going around all the way through there. So, but the one thing that is sure is if we could completely secure our southern border, we probably would see drugs coming across the northern border, because the drug cartels are very much entrepreneurial organizations. They're not going to stop. The other thing that we have to deal with as a country that we have not talked about nearly enough is the demand side. As long as we demand methamphetamine, as long as we demand opiates, as long as we demand illicit marijuana, guess what? Somebody's going to provide it.
Yes.
And they're going to make billions and billions of dollars a year. In that same vein, I just read a study from the RAND Corporation that was just published talking about how much money is being made smuggling human beings. And they're estimating it's somewhere around $200 million to $2.3 billion a year.
Oh, my God.
The human smugglers are making. Now, this is a RAND Corporation, which, you know, it's not some, you know, wacky group. And what they're saying is that they believe, by their research, the drug cartels are not specifically profiteering from it. But the smugglers are paying a tax to the cartels that control the avenues into this country. So in some ways, the trafficking of human beings is becoming nearly as profitable as the trafficking of drugs. And if this is not a humanitarian crisis, that's what really, I guess, fires me up, gets me as close to excited as I get, is this assertion by some that there's not a crisis. I'm sorry. I don't know how you get your mind there. We had 70,000 overdose deaths last year from opiates. The deaths from opiates were greater than the deaths from traffic accidents. Now, that's shocking. I give you another thing that shocks me. As a law enforcement person that started in 81, I now have my deputies carrying medicine on their person, Narcan. Now, we need to pause and think about that. We're now carrying on law enforcement officers' persons medicine in the same way that we might carry a gun or a flashlight or a radio.
Saving lives, trying to save lives.
Right. That should be shocking to tell us about the scope of this problem, but we're not paying attention. It's mired in this idiotic partisan debate about who wins and whose problem it is and who's to blame. I think we send people to Washington, D.C. for better reasons than this. And I'm very disappointed that Washington, D.C. does not, in a bipartisan way, talk to the experts on the ground, because sheriffs don't have a partisan dog in the fight. We really don't. Most of us don't. I know Wilmot, Daniels, and I do not. We're not driven by partisan ideology. We're driven by a commitment for public safety in our counties.
As a whole.
As
it should be.
And you know what? Public safety does not know Republican. It doesn't know Democrat. It's not a partisan issue. It's a community issue. It's a quality of life issue. And it's disappointing to us that we see this mired in this endless political debate in D.C. We deserve better than this.
Absolutely. And in my mantra, every time I'm on the show and we're talking about narcotics, is stop supporting the cartel. There's enough places in Tucson, in Pima County, to get help with insurance or without insurance. If you want to be off the drugs, it's up to you. You can be off the drugs.
Yeah, the addictive qualities of opiates are really off the map. They really are. And it's unfortunate these people get addicted, and it's very hard to get off. But we have to do something with the demand side.
We do have the resources to get them off the drugs. Yeah. So we have a caller, Ingrid. What's on your mind?
Good morning. The demand aspect of this whole subject is what is so troublesome and makes people very unhappy. Our children have been targeted by drug pushers and have been made into addicts. So, of course, you're going to have demand. What are the laws regarding giving drugs to minors? Many of these minors are now prostituting themselves in order to relieve their symptoms. And they're probably afraid of their parents. How are we going to handle this?
Well, Ingrid, that's a good question. There are, of course, laws dealing with the giving of illegal drugs to minors. We have plenty of laws, but we've got to look at the community. We've kind of got to get back to the basics on a little bit of this. And there's got to be a little bit more funding, I think, as part of looking at the border mission. I would like to see some additional funding for prevention, treatment efforts, education efforts. We've got to stem the tide of this. You know, if you look back 25 years ago, tobacco use, smoking, was much more prevalent in this country than it is today. And we have done a pretty good job of that. Some of us are old enough to remember, and it's hard to even believe today, that you used to be able to smoke in the back of a commercial airliner.
Yes.
During a flight.
Yes.
Now we think about that today and we think, well, that is absurd. That's the silliest thing I've ever heard of. Or that you used to be able to walk through an airport or a restaurant and smoke and it was no big deal. Well, I think we can make some of the same inroads with illicit drugs. We just got to have a commitment to do so. The other thing we don't talk about enough, and that I'm passionate about, is the violence in Mexico. On the other side of the border, the violence associated with the drug trade is unimaginable. I saw a study that said, maybe, I think it was 2016, they estimated there might have been as many as 26,000 drug-related homicides in Mexico. Well, that's a shocking number.
Yes, it is.
So we've got to get a handle on this, and we've got to stop. It's not a partisan issue.
No, it's absolutely not a partisan issue. And people need to realize I've had parents call me after the show, what can I do to get my child off drugs? and we've given them the resources, told them where to go and who can help them. Even in Phoenix, we had somebody call from Phoenix, what can I do? And it's gratifying to know that you have the resources here that are going to help people get off the drugs, get away from spending all your money on the stupidity, and help others.
Well, what's troubling, Sherry, is that there are still people who would call a radio program and ask, where can I get this help? Which says that we're not doing a good job
of getting it out there.
Absolutely. And we need to do a better job of that.
Okay. I want to talk to you about the drug bus that I know several months back, you and Mark Daniels had a huge drug bust, but you continue to have these happening. Tell us what's going on with this.
Well, it speaks of the crisis on our borders. It used to be when I was a street cop, if you found 2 ounces or 3 ounces of methamphetamine, you had a really big bust. Recently, my deputies have done interdictions of 25, 50, 90 pounds of methamphetamine. You know, you go back just a few years ago, this was unheard of. I mean, we never thought that you'd be doing this much methamphetamine. There are a couple things we know about that drug. One is it's not being cooked locally. We don't have meth labs in our community anymore. That's just not part of the landscape anymore. It's being cooked south of the border. And when we interdict 25, 50 pounds here in Tucson, there's two things we know. One is it's not going to be consumed locally. That's going all over the country. And two, for every time we do that, we're missing 10. You know, because the drug cartels are doing that because more often than not, they're successful. They're business people.
Right.
For all the problems of drug cartels, they are business people. And so they're sending 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds across the border, it's because they're going to believe they're going to be successful more than they're not, and they are. So these drugs are going all over the country. My deputies did 13,000 fentanyl pills several months ago. 13,000. Now, that's shocking. Those pills were destined for all over the country. They were going to cause addiction and overdose deaths. We've got to get a handle on this.
So where are they coming? Where are they coming through the border?
Well, to the best of our knowledge right now, the major vulnerability are the ports of entry. The drug war has changed a lot in the last 20 years. But I have a very unique relationship with the New York Times. And I actually have nothing but praise for the Times and the relationship I have with the Times. But I talked to the Washington, D.C. Bureau when I was back there a month ago, and the editor of the Times for D.C. and several of the key reporters. And I said, you're asserting that if we secured the ports of entry, because that's currently where the drugs are coming through, that should be our main focus. And they said, absolutely, Sheriff. This whole talk of securing the border to help the drug war is just stupid. It's silly. I said, okay, let me follow your logic tree just for a minute here. So we secure the ports of entry so the drug cartels cannot transact drugs through our ports of entry. They can no longer traffic them through the ports of entry. And you're saying that would help our problem. They said, absolutely. I said, okay, let me follow your logic just one more step. So you're asserting that after we do that, the drug cartels are going to sit around a conference table somewhere in Mexico and go, oh, darn it, we've got to get a job at the factory now. No, they're going to exploit the next vulnerability, the next vulnerability, and the next vulnerability.
They'll figure out a way.
They're going to figure out a way. So we can't say that there's a silver bullet. There is no silver bullet. Everybody wants to believe that you can say two words, like the wall, and everything will be fine. No, this is going to have to be a very comprehensive, ongoing solution because they're going to continue to defeat whatever we're trying to do.
Okay. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Pima County Sheriff Mark Napier, who just grabbed some water. He's feeling a little under the weather, and I really appreciate you coming in and doing this when, you know, you're not up to par right now.
Yeah, I just hope I can keep my radio voice for a while longer.
Just hang in there. If you have any questions, our phone number is 790-2040. And I want to talk to you about, I had several questions about sanctuary cities.
Okay.
Arizona doesn't have any sanctuary anything. One of the questions that came in was, is this something that somebody can willy-nilly say, okay, we're going to be a sanctuary city, or is it something that gets voted on?
Well, my understanding is that it would be voted on by the municipality or the the government of that locality. Let me be perfectly clear. I do not support that. It is an affront to the oath that we take. When you're elected to office, you take an oath. And one of the things that's in that oath is you will support and defend the Constitution and laws, blah, blah, blah. So you cannot turn your eye away from the law because it's currently convenient. And I don't think anybody should. I have a philosophical objection with that, is that some people would say, well, Sheriff, you should not follow laws that you find to be unconscionable. And I said, do you really want to empower me to decide which laws are good and which laws are bad? We have three branches of government that are supposed to do that. We have a law branch that enforces laws, a branch that interprets laws, and a branch that makes laws. I'm in the branch that enforces laws. So you don't want me to interpret or make laws, do you?
Because pick and choose.
No, I don't think that anybody wants me. I don't want sheriffs to be empowered to decide what's a good law and what's a bad law. We take an oath to enforce the law. And if they don't like the law, there's a way to change the law. And there's appropriate way. It's not to have an edict that says we're going to ignore the law. No one should think that that's a good idea. It sets a dangerous precedent, and I'm philosophically opposed to it. Now, that being said, I think we can, and my department does have, policies, because we don't want people that are in this country without proper documentation to feel they cannot interact with law enforcement. So we have a policy in my department that says, look, if you are a victim or a witness of crime and you come forward and immigration status has nothing to do with what we're investigating, we won't ask about it because it's not part of what we're about. We're not federal immigration enforcement agents.
Right.
And if a woman is being abused by her husband, she happens to be in this country without proper documentation, I don't want her to not feel she can come to law enforcement out of fear of being deported. She needs to have the recourse to be able to come to us. And I think that's important. I think you can make these differentiations without ignoring the law. And I don't think anybody wants us to ignore the law.
I did some research about sanctuary cities. And what I found, and I believe this is a list from 2017, so it might be a little bit different now, but there are 8 states. And within the U.S., there are 27 states that have cities or counties designated as sanctuary that include 33 cities, 136 counties, and 2 states, New Mexico and Rhode Island, allow their county jails to be sanctuary areas for people. With that many resources available, I personally don't think Tucson or Arizona should be adding to this list. But the bigger question is, how does law enforcement do their job when these areas are technically thumbing their nose to federal law?
Well, again, I'm a purist in that regard, is that I think that I'm in the branch of the government that enforces laws, and I took an oath to do so. I'm not going to violate that oath. I think it's very troublesome when in a community takes a vote that is outside their purview. In other words, they don't create laws.
Right.
And they're saying, okay, we're just going to ignore the law because it's currently fashionable, or we think that there's some altruistic motive for not following the law. That's a dangerous precedent to set. There are ways that we can still be compassionate to the plight of people that are here without proper documentation, still provide service and the things that we need to do. I'll give you an example. Right now, my jail is making 150 sack lunches every day for the people that are asylum seekers. Now, people understand that once Border Patrol gets the request for asylum, they process these people. Then they're given an asylum hearing, sometimes weeks or months down the road. In the gap between when Border Patrol releases them and that asylum hearing, they're no longer in this country illegally because they're in that sweet spot where they're between the asylum hearing and us, the government, federal government, saying, okay, we're going to let you be heard for your asylum claim. Well, they're now dumping these people. Dumping is not the right word. I'm sorry to my Border Patrol friends, but they're now releasing these people into our communities. Well, our nonprofits and stuff are taking care of these people. Well, they came to me and they said, Sheriff, we're really struggling to feed these people.
Right.
You make 6,000 meals a day for the jail. Do you have some process where you could make sack lunches or something. And I said, of course we do. And furthermore, I have the capacity to do it because the jail population is down right now. So we're making about 150 sack lunches a day. And people, some people are going to be mad at me for that. But here's the bottom line is I'm a Christian. And these people are human beings. They right. need to eat. And as a Christian, as a person of compassion and so forth, I can't say, well, no, I'm going to, they're going to starve. Well, because right now the federal government has said, okay, you have at least enough of a valid claim for asylum that we're going to give you a hearing. So during that period between when they acknowledge that and when the asylum hearing is heard, they're not illegal. They're released on their own recognizance into the community. Now, I can hear the people on the right screaming right now that, yes, you're right, that we know the vast majority or a significant majority of these people that are released into the community are never coming back for that asylum hearing. We know that. We know that from past experience. Nonetheless, that's the federal process right now. That's not a county sheriff process. That is a federal process. So your grievance is not with the county sheriffs, it's with the federal government, because that's a process that they're engaged in,
right?
Because that's what the law is. So it's a giant mess is what it is right now. We've never experienced anything like this. The influx of family units, the significant unprecedented migration from Central America to the United States. The number of unaccompanied minors, people under the age of 18.
That just blows me away that a parent can just say, here, walk north, right when you find work.
What? We had a story where they found an 8-year-old child just standing around in the desert with their name and some phone numbers on their shoes.
Wow.
But we have to understand, too, I think, again, as compassionate, thoughtful people, that the plight of some of these folks in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, it's just terrible. And if you or I were in their similar life circumstance, I'm not sure that we wouldn't make a similar decision. Is I can't live here. It's unsafe. I can't provide for my family, et cetera. And these people begin a journey that is very, very dangerous.
Yes.
They're paying drug cartels. Some estimates are that it's as much as $7,000.
Wow.
That they're paying the smugglers to get into this country. We have to do something.
What if they took, what if they set up offices in these countries that said, hey, if you want to migrate to America, here's the process and let's help you do it legally and safely, which is, I think, more important, do it in a humanitarian manner than just...
Well, then the issue comes, can we, and these are issues far above my pay grade as a sheriff, but the issue becomes, can we accept everyone who presents themselves? And the answer is probably no, that we can't absorb all those people into this country.
Well, yeah, but that's the same at the border, too. If you run a background check and they're wanted for something or they've got a criminal record, aren't they going to say go back?
Well, but see, so many of these people are actually very, very good people. They're kind. They want good things for their family. But even so, can we accept all of the good people that want to come here? And the answer is probably not, that we probably can't. So how do you vet that? And then you're, going to incentivize the same illegal behavior that, people are going to try to come here anyway, because once they come here, the supposition that once a person without proper documentation gets into this country, that they engage in criminality at a much higher rate than anybody else's faults. It's not true. Every once in a while someone will act out like that, and it's tragic. Make no mistake about that. That person should not have been in this country and then commits a homicide here. That is a tragedy. Make no mistake. But there's no evidence to suggest that the average person coming into this country commits crime at a higher rate. It's not borne out by empirical data.
I think what one of the conversations that I had was, some of these people, do they have job skills? Are they being trained in some type of an arena that will help them sustain for themselves? Or are we going to continuously be housing, feeding, clothing until they become citizens and can go out and get a legitimate job? And I had an attorney on here probably about a year ago, and he said some of the process, especially coming from Mexico, can take up to 20 years to become a citizen. So, it's kind of between a rock and a hard place. How do you separate the humanitarian effort from, okay, let's get you skilled so you can sustain for yourself instead of...
Well, it's a difficult because right now the economy is booming. So, you know, we need people to frame houses and do all kinds of labor because we have a labor shortage.
Yeah.
Because the economy is booming right now. So we could, in theory, I guess, again, this is beyond the pay grade of a sheriff, but we
help
could
train them.
We could assimilate them into the economy right now. And the problem is once they come into this country without proper documentation, they're illegal. And so to get them out of the dark economy, where they are paying taxes, where they are engaged, where they're not being financially victimized because of, you know, their inability to not work legally in this country, it is an exceptionally complex issue. We have 11 or 14 million people in this country already without proper documentation. Now we're going to have many thousands of more. And I the Border Patrol would tell you that no one knows what the end game is on this. They're going to keep coming. We don't know how to stop it right now. And we're in the catch and release phase, just like we were under previous administrations. That's what's happening right now.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Sheriff Mark Napier, and we've been talking about sanctuary cities. We've been hosting a lot of different topics. I want to shift gears here. What about distracted driving? How do you... embrace, how does the county go after people with a distracted driving, and what do you consider distracted driving?
Well, certainly if you're texting, if you're watching a YouTube video on your phone while you're driving.
Reading the newspaper.
Yeah, you know, we're too distracted with driving. There's no question about that. And does it add to accidents? Unquestionably, it does. I'm not in that vein that says we should give everybody a $100 ticket for that. I do encourage my deputies, if you're out there and you see that, it's a chance for education. Yes. You stop somebody and you say, really, was that that important that you had to do that? Do you know that if you'd crashed into somebody, or let's say that you'd hit a child while you were texting, do you know that now becomes criminal? This, the impact on your life could be devastating, financially, criminally.
It's a life changer.
It's a life changer. So please knock it off. Don't do it. I think we all have times where we have to feel compelled to look at the phone. I remember telling my father, I said, you are so lucky that you retired before technology.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you were out of the office, you were gone.
Yeah.
The phone rang, nobody picked it up, so you must not be there. And somebody would wait. And now I carry my phone with me 24/7, 365. I love my friends in Washington, D.C. I do. But what they'll do is they'll get to the office, and about 8:05 in the morning, they have things they want to communicate to the sheriffs in Arizona because we have such great partnership. So they start paging me. Well, they don't know that it's 5 o'clock in the morning here. And there's occasions where I like to sleep past 5 o'clock in the morning.
Once or twice a week, maybe.
But we're so tied to technology, and it's become, we've lost our ability to communicate to people. That's the other thing. And, you know, I think that's unfortunate that I was at a restaurant with my wife last night. You look around and see how many people are sitting at a restaurant, and they've got their head down, looking at their phones. This is the time.
Everybody at the table.
This is the time that you're supposed to be talking to one another, that you're supposed to be enjoying each other's company and stuff. And we've lost the ability to do that.
I think people think distracted driving is just your phone, looking on your phone. People are eating burgers and French fries going down the road. They've got their dog sitting in their lap.
Women doing their makeup.
Yeah. I saw that just 2 days ago. Girl putting on mascara. The light's green. Hello. You know, do that at home. So distracted driving takes on a lot of different...
It's a lot of things. Driving with your dog on your lap.
That's one of my pet peeves.
There's a lot of things that we take for granted, the task of driving. One of my sidelines, I've done a lot of things in my life. I've been, my wife sometimes saying I'm bipolar, but I'm on a manic episode that never ends. I taught people to drive race cars in California, and these people would get into a race car, and they'd just been out on the interstate going 80 miles an hour. Now they're in a race car. They've got a cage around them. They're in seat belts. They've got a helmet on. And you start to tell them about the consequences of crashing at 140, 150 miles an hour, and all of a sudden, they've lost their nerve. We think we can't crash. It becomes such a commonplace occurrence of driving a vehicle that we take it so far for granted that we don't realize it is a very dangerous and complex thing to do.
It's a huge weapon.
And I would see people, I mean, grown men, become so nervous in a race car that they would drive maybe 85 or 90 miles an hour at California Speedway, which is a 2-mile oval that you can easily drive close to 200 miles an hour at safely, if you can drive. And they'd completely lose their nerve because all of a sudden it was real. I could crash. I could injure myself. I could get hurt.
This could be it.
And that's how you drive a race car fast, is you have to abandon your idea of self-preservation. I was always willing to do that. You have to be willing to hurt yourself. You've got to be willing to crash to the point where you'll very seriously injure yourself, or you can't drive fast.
My son is graduating. In fact, today's my son's birthday. Happy birthday, Eric.
Well, if we're going to do that, I think my wife, Marlene, might be listening. I love you, honey. I'm sorry that I'm not home this morning. I know that you went out and walked the doggy. I'll be home here pretty soon. But no, I've been blessed. Marlene's been married to me for almost 36 years now.
Wow.
She started as a nurse in 1980. I started as a police officer in 1981. And we never dreamed we'd end up where we are today. We couldn't have. We were living in a trailer that was a single wide 12 by 70 trailer when we got married, that the heater didn't work very often.
Oh, no.
The first year we were married, both of us working full time, made $36,000 that year. Me as a cop and her as a nurse.
Wow.
And what's come a long way. It's been a great journey. You get to a certain point in your life and you start reflecting back and you think about what meaning your life had, if it had any or whatever. And, this has been a hell of a life journey. I mean, I went from being a young, skinny, good-looking policeman. Now, some people just laughed who knew me. In Iowa in 1981 to being the sheriff of one of the largest counties in the United States here in 2019. What an amazing journey. I mean, I've been blessed. I've got 4 adult children that are fabulous. They're now teamed up with other fabulous people. And I've got a granddaughter who's awesome. So
how's your granddaughter doing?
Oh, she's great. She was over to the house yesterday helping me water plants, and she ended up watering the grandpa very successfully.
There you go.
somehow that hose ended up on grandpa, and she thought that was hilarious.
I do too.
it's been a great journey. I hope to be sheriff here for a while longer. I'd like to spend 2 more terms with the people of Pima County, and that would take me to 2028. That'd be 47 years after I started. That's probably enough.
Wow.
And, but I've got some things I want to do yet. My heart for service is still pure. I still care about this community. Even after I'm not sheriff, this will be my home. This is where my kids live. This is where I live, where my granddaughter lives.
You're invested in this community.
I love this community. This is my home. And, if you don't care about it, service, if you don't care about your community, I got a solution for you. Don't become an elected official. It's not about you. My mother was great about saying that. She'd look at me and say, son, it ain't all about you. It's not about you. And what she meant was it's about service. It's about character. It's about, for her, being a traditional person and me being very traditional, it's about how you define what a man is. Men take care of their families. Men keep their commitments. So it isn't all about you. It's not about being convenient, or I guess if I were looking just for me, I'd retire right now because I can retire right now and go play golf every day or do whatever. But that's still, my heart is still in service, and I've got some miles still left on this chassis and some things I'd like to do for our sheriff's department and for this community that are yet undone. So we'll see if the people of this county want to keep me around for a while.
Is there an election coming up?
Yeah, 2020. It's a ways off yet, but we'll see. We'll see what the will of the voters are, and I'll talk more with my family. But I still love this. I love being a cop. I love this job. And I'm so darn proud of so many of the deputies. There were last night while I was trying to sleep. I don't sleep very well. There were deputies out there taking calls. And I had young people in the pods at the jail that were, you know, interacting with prisoners and doing things. And we had civilian staff doing things to support our mission.
24/7.
I am so darn proud of these people. And
speaking of the jail, what about did you see it on the news? The jails, the cells up, I think it's in Northern Arizona, the cells that don't lock and the prisoners can come and go. Did you see that?
No, I did not see that.
Oh, look it up. It's pretty scary stuff, but I think those are privately run jails. So,
okay.
And not very well, apparently. My son did his master's program on bicycle safety in Tucson, and he gave his presentation the other night. And there are some areas in Tucson, intersections, that are more dangerous than others. What can we do? I've got a theory in my head, but what can we do to make it safer in Tucson for people to ride their bikes? And one of the intersections they were talking about is Benson Highway, and I think it was 6th Avenue, where it's not really safe to be riding a bike. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a couple of things. One is you have to have there are two things, two E's there. One is education, the other one's enforcement. So you've got to do those in tandem with one another. But part of that education has got to be toward riders. You know, we talk about pedestrian safety. Well, very often the problem is the pedestrian behavior. They're running between crosswalks wearing dark clothing at night, yeah, and they're getting hit. So we've got to do an education campaign and then an enforcement campaign, both directed toward the driver, but also to the dangerous behavior of bicyclists that are not following the rules.
Let me tell you what happened. This happened 3 weeks ago. I drive southbound on Campbell. There's a 3-lane highway. I drive southbound to get to the station. This happened on Saturday morning. I was approaching the University Boulevard, which on Campbell, that's going right into the mall area, mm-hmm, of the university. There were cars in each lane. We had a green light, so there was no reason to slow down. All of a sudden, there was like 10, 15 bicyclists going from east to west, blasting through, all wearing their helmets and their matchy-matchy spandex. Message. Totally blew the red light. We all slammed on our brakes. That could have been a very, very ugly scene. And I was like, what the heck are you thinking?
Well, and then if the bicyclists get hit, the community first says, well, those darn unsafe drivers of vehicles.
Exactly.
You know, and sometimes it is the cyclist and the pedestrian behavior that causes the problem. So it's got to be an education enforcement component. And then again, we've got to take the task of driving more seriously. And I see a lot of people that, you know, there'll be a car coming in the opposite direction. There's a bicyclist there. Well, rather than simply slow down just a little bit, just, you don't have to come to a complete stop, but slow down a little bit, allow that car in the opposite direction to clear, and then give that bicyclist good spacing. Well, it only takes a second, but we're in such a hurry,
yeah,
in this country anymore that a 30-second delay is the end of the world, you know, yeah, and we've got to drive 90 miles an hour up I-10 because we slept in, we hit that darn snooze button and slept in another 9 minutes. Are we crazy?
What I would like to see is, I know the bicyclists have to follow rules of the road. I would like to see the city or the county, whoever, the state, enforce. They have to go to traffic school for their bike and get a sticker, pay for that sticker to be on their bike so that they're more aware. It seems like people who ride bikes, oh, it's just a bike. No, you've got to be aware of what the laws are. Be aware of your surroundings.
Well, then law enforcement's got to have the capacity to do enforcement activity.
That too.
You know, and the staffing level at Tucson Police is strained to be able to do proactive enforcement activity. I hear my deputies, and I'm so glad that they're out there stopping traffic all the time. I hear them as I go from point A to point B. They're stopping traffic. Again, I'm not concerned if they issue a citation so much as I am that they're getting a visible presence in the community. And face it, when you see somebody else pulled over, you start to think about your own driving behavior a little
bit. Yeah, I'm looking for more because they run around in packs,
yeah,
don't they?
Well, we don't want to be by ourselves. I mean, come on.
Well, yeah. I want to thank you because I know you're feeling under the weather.
Yeah,
you came in.
Well, you're a good friend, Sherry, and Mom told me to keep my commitments.
There you go. Okay, I want to tell everybody, next week we're going to be talking about the homeless program in Tucson and how it's going to be affected if we become a sanctuary city, which I think is a huge mistake.
Well, and it's being impacted right now because our nonprofits are so strained with the asylum seekers right now that we're not able to feed our hungry people and take care of our own people here in this community right now. So it is a major problem.
Yes, and I want everybody to think twice before they go voting to become a sanctuary city, especially when we have all these other resources and all these other states that have obviously committed to helping these people. But it takes money.
It does.
And if we don't have it, we can't do it. So tune in next week for that. Until then, I want everybody to shop local, stay safe, and check out lawmatters1030.org. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you.